This is Reckonings, where people speak their conscience. I'm Stephanie Lepp, and you're listening to part two in a two-part conversation with prominent economist and public intellectual Glenn Lowry. In the first part, we talked about Lowry's early neoconservative views, we talked about extramarital affairs, we talked about drugs, we talked about religion, and now we get to grapple with the impact of Lowry's worldview transformation from the neoconservative right to a more nuanced progressive position on the left. So you went into recovery, you were born again, came out, left Harvard for Boston University, and then eventually ended up at Brown, which is where you are today. Now, start to draw the line for us from religious conversion to worldview transformation. How did you start shifting from right to left?
The spiritual rebirth that I experienced, I mean, it made me more humble in a deep way. It perhaps shifted my values somewhat because, you know, this idea that, you know, I got my friends, I got my enemies, let me figure out what side of the line somebody is on and let me slit their throat if they're on the wrong side of the line. That's not very Christian. There's not a whole lot of love in that. So I think that definitely was a phenomenon that dislodged me a little bit from my certitude.
Mm.
But some things happened, like the bell curve. This is the bell curve, the book, 1994. Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein on intelligence and class structure in American life. I despised that book. I see that it's propaganda. I see that it's fast and loose with the data. It's just pablum. It's not social science at all. He basically says the average IQ of Africans, as best we can measure it, is 75. Do you have any idea what that means? If the mean is 100 and a standard deviation is 15, 75 means that half the African population are idiots, according to standard measures of intelligence. Okay? Now, I don't believe that, and I don't think Charles Murray knows that. Neither do I think the data that he cites demonstrates it. God damn it. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, and the thing was, when I went to Christopher DeMute, the head of the American Enterprise Institute, and I said, come on, we're the American Enterprise Institute. I'm a member of your Council of Academic Advisors, and I'm telling you that the social science communities are sharply critical, and in the interest of an objective public service, Charles should answer, and Charles Murray hadn't answered at all. And DeMuth said to me, Charles is tired of the bell curve debate and wants to move on. And I realized, you put this fucking book out
there.
Yeah,
that's not an answer.
You know, and it's insinuated itself into the popular culture, and he's tired? So then I had to ask myself, who are these people? And more significantly, I had to ask myself, who am I in bed with these people? I became infuriated by that book.
And but you had read things like that in the past. Why had they not infuriated you the way that they did this time?
This is a very good question. I don't know.
I'm just going to riff here. And I want to reference an excellent Vox article by Ezra Klein called How Politics Makes Us Stupid, which talks about this notion of identity protective cognition, whereby our worldviews are intimately tied up with our identities and our communities, which is what can make worldviews so hard to change because, you know, changing our worldview often requires changing our entire identity and our social ecosystem. Your situation is almost a converse of that, where your religious conversion had you feeling, you know, more humble and more compassionate and perhaps more sensitive to a lack of humility and compassionate thinking among your conservative colleagues. And so instead of not wanting to change your worldview because you didn't want to change your community, you were kind of ready to change your community, which made it easier to change your worldview. You know, it was like, whose team do you want to be on or not on? And what does that say about you and your views?
That's not an unreasonable speculation. I had been ostracized by my fellow intellectuals and academics who were Black. There may have been some class differences, but we were all Blacks and had come along at roughly the same time. And I was always ostracized by those people. And I must admit that that chafed. And I must also admit that the pain of that was diminished to the extent that while I might have been persona non grata amongst the Negro cognoscenti, I was definitely a hero to the neoconservative crowd. But when I found that I wasn't able to any longer be happy with my association with these folks, yeah, I was kind of now in really, really kind of in no man's land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has someplace to go when the music stops. They're going to Jerusalem. They're going to Dublin. They're going somewhere. I can't have a people. I cannot be a full person and be respected in that.
Hmm.
You know, some of this is about me, not about Glenn Lowry, the person, not the Black guy, not the guy that grew up in church. You know, just what kind of type is he? And so being a contrarian, being argumentative,
mm-hmm.
I am not a crowd type. I'm not following anybody's herd. If everybody is marching left, I'm looking right because I just, you know, I'm going to think for myself. I don't.
But how do you even trust yourself? Because that's also a formulaic way to, in a way, you're following the herd because you're just going the opposite direction of the herd.
True. And therein lies a great danger, doesn't it? The herd's not wrong all the time, is it? And if I'm reacting, I'm not thinking. So what you say is absolutely fair.
I don't know. This is kind of a weird question, but how do you feel like, given that your views have changed so much, how do you feel like you can trust what you believe?
I mean, one of the things that comes with this identity, you know, when you envelop yourself in a, from the, in terms of your political views, in the kind of security of an all-embracing identity, is that you don't have to ask yourself that question. So I'm not answering you. I'm just reading.
Well, does that make you less attached to your current worldview because, or have some kind of equanimity because you understand that they might change?
Yeah, a kind of equanimity, maybe even a little bit of a bemusement. You know, and certainly a kind of modesty, a kind of humility, you know, I could be wrong.
And what do you think are the implications of that equanimity for your thinking and your scholarship?
Well, I think it's a good thing that I have less certitude about my views and that I'm less righteous, self-righteous. I think that makes me a better contributor to the discourses in which I'm involved.
Hmm.
I kind of am chastising myself a little bit in retrospect for having not been more independent.
Well, actually, that's interesting. That's a little ironic because you have called yourself a contrarian and you were almost a contrarian in the bigger sense of being a Black neoconservative, but you kind of adopted the entire neocon agenda,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so.
And I was, my detractors say, a pathetic mascot of the right. There is actually some merit in all three of those descriptors. Pathetic, in retrospect. Mascot, well, as I say, they didn't take me seriously as a human being. When I started thinking for myself, people kicked me to the curb. And of the right, well, I certainly contributed to the legitimacy of that way of seeing things.
Hmm. So we have an emerging sense of why you shifted from right to left. You know, religious conversion made you more humble, led to dissatisfaction with your conservative colleagues, along with the desire for a place in the progressive Black community, you know, altogether kind of creating the conditions conducive to you considering a move to the left and then actually moving left. I want to go deeper into why you swung left when you did. And for that, I'm going to quote a 2002 New York Times piece on you by Adam Schatz. He asks you why it took you so long to leave the right, given the Reagan administration's conservative party line on race. And you replied, why the 90s and not the 80s? I'm going to give you an honest answer. I'd say you're dealing with a 35-year-old kid in 1983. Schatz goes on to write, "It's not an especially satisfying reply. After all, this, quote, 35-year-old kid was a tenured professor at Harvard. Lowry's conversion narrative is compelling stuff, but there's something missing. The story fails to explain why he began to notice things that were perhaps there all along. It fails to explain how the disapproval of blacks went from being a badge of pride to one of shame." So how would you respond to this question today of why the 90s and not the 80s?
Yeah, I don't know if I have any really good answer for you, any better answer than I gave Adam, although that one was pretty lame, I admit. 35-year-old kid? Come on, that's ridiculous.
Are you going to say the same thing about the answer you're about to give right now in another 13 years? We'll come back in 13 years
I was going to
and
give a
see what
different
you
kind of
think.
answer. I was going to point to events and not to my stage of my life cycle.
Okay.
I was going to point to the bell curve. I was going to point to my kind of break with the commentary
Well,
crowd.
those show that you left the right, but not why you did it when you did.
I mean, we've got a lot to work with here. I had gone through the humiliation of the fall from grace and the.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, it's an entire the entire constellation of your life
Yes.
is the answer.
Yeah, that's indeed the entire constellation of my life is my. I mean, I was continuing to be married to the same woman who would have never voted for Ronald Reagan, and who the nature of our discussions had been at one time in my. And I'm sorry to have to report this, but it's true. In my life, it had been, shut up, little lady. I know better. Not literally, but that was my attitude. I wasn't listening. And here are our kids coming along, and suddenly it's a whole new life. The 80s is not the 90s, as far as my relationship with Linda Thatcher Lowry is concerned. We're raising children. We're making a home.
Do you listen to her now?
She's dead.
Oh, did you
I
listen to her
wish, but
before she
that's where
left?
I'm going with this. I
Yeah.
started listening to her.
Oh, okay. Good.
I mean,
Good.
she'd been pushing back all the time in her gentle way. I started listening, and I think she helped to modulate, helped to center me.
Do you foresee your views continuing to change as dramatically as they have in the past?
Every now and then, when I'm watching Fox News or something, I can feel that old thing coming up in me. So anti-political correctness. Okay, so man, I can definitely relate to that. All right. If Ben Carson or Donald Trump say, I ain't doing it just because they think I'm supposed to do it, I'm saying what I really think. Man, I
Right.
can really relate to that.
Is that just openness to all views and just really taking things in as you agree with them or don't, not based on where they come from? Or is there something else going on, you know?
Yeah, there is something going on, but I don't know exactly how to name it. It's not only that I'm cognitively or intellectually willing to hear both sides, and sometimes I hear something from the right that makes sense to me on Fox News. That's true, but that's not it. There's some other more visceral stuff that's going on that I'm not quite sure how to name it, but I know it's there because sometimes I'll settle in and my head will be nodding, and then the inveterate racism. That is lurking, just beneath in the subtext of a lot that's being said, will come through.
Let's talk about your regrets. First, just from your entire journey, what do you feel most regretful about?
Well, I want to get personal here, and I want to talk about my infidelity to my wife, and I want to talk about my contempt for our marriage. If I had my way, and if this woman hadn't been so steadfast and courageous, my life would be completely different and much impoverished. So I regret that in those years when I was just running wild, when I became a crack cocaine addict, when I had affairs and picked up women on the street, and when I basically came home when I bothered to come home and told my wife, if you don't like it, then leave. When she was pregnant and lost the pregnancy, and I was thinking in the back of my head, oh my God, oh my God, I just dodged a bullet. Okay? I mean, I'm so profoundly ashamed of that. And I'm so grateful that notwithstanding my knuckleheadedness, she hung in there. I didn't deserve that. But nevertheless, I was blessed in that way.
Do you feel like you made amends with her for all of your regrets?
Yes and no. We went through the end together. It was a good death. You can say that. But there were some things we never talked about. And the little speech that I just gave you about my regrets, I don't know that I ever actually said it to her. Not quite that way. So for our 25th wedding anniversary, 2008, I wrote a letter to her in which I expressed my love and my profound gratitude and my own, imperfectness, which I was owning up to. And when she died, and my son Glenn and I went to clean out her office at Tufts University, we found this letter framed, sitting in a place of honor on her bookshelf. And when I saw that letter and I realized what it had meant to her, that she had framed it, and I realized that I had only scratched the surface in that letter. I mean, because I can remember some of the conversations that she and I had had during the difficult times and shortly thereafter, where again, my attitude was, you can leave, you can stay. Either way is fine with me. And where she was trying to make me aware of how much it was hurting her. And, my attitude was, well, if it hurts that bad, I guess you're not going to stay. There was just so much injury that I never really tried to make amends for.
Did you know that there was so much injury before she died that you hadn't kind of, talked to her about? And if you knew that, why didn't you say it?
I didn't want to own up. Okay? I still wanted to parse it in terms of I was going through a phase. Some people have open marriages. We survived it. What's your beef? I didn't want to accept full responsibility for having taken toward our marriage an attitude so different from that which she had taken.
When did you accept responsibility? Before or after she died?
I don't,
I, at
I,
least in
I'm,
your heart.
no, I'm not, I, you know, this very moment now is revelatory to me in a certain sense. When my son found out that I had been unfaithful to his mother, he was appalled. And again, my view with him was, it was a long time ago, Glenn. And no, the character that I exhibited was not always exemplary. And yes, your mother is a saint, but you don't have a right to have an opinion about the character of my marriage to your mother over all of those years, including those years before you were even conceived. I'm wrong about that, Stephanie. I'm perhaps only now seeing how wrong I am about that. Of course, he has a right to have that opinion. He can feel the pain. I mean, even though we're talking about events that occurred before he was born, he knows how that might have impacted upon his mother. And that he comes to me about that shouldn't be met by me with a kind of dismissal and I'm kind of pulling rank on him. I'm your father. You can't understand. You couldn't possibly understand what my life was like or what the relationship. You can't. You're in no position to have an opinion about my relationship to your mother. No, he can't possibly understand my life. That's certainly true. And no, he doesn't know everything that might have gone down in the intimate relations that I had with this woman. But she's his mother. This is our family. What he's honoring in calling me to account is something that I should be prepared to credit, it seems to me. Now,
this is Reckonings. My guest is prominent economist Glenn Lowry. Next up, we're going to talk about the specific fallout from his widely disseminated neoconservative views. So now taking regret into the realm of your worldview transformation, in your neoconservative days, you gave a talk to an intimate gathering of civil rights leaders. Coretta Scott King was in the room. She was so upset with your contention that Black society was responsible for Black problems that she wept at the end of your talk. You dismissed that then. How do you feel about that now?
She represented something. And there she was in my presence. It was a room with 10 people in it, you know? And I was being taken so seriously, and the impact of what I had to say on her was so profound. It ought to have given me pause, oughtn't it? I mean, it didn't. I had no humility. You know, the Lowry of today would reproach that young man for being so arrogant. And I would say, chill, and, you know, and take a deep breath. And man, it's not all about you, and you don't know everything. And here is Coretta Scott King in front of you weeping. You need to think about that. Not necessarily that because she cries, you should therefore reformulate your entire political vision, but you at least take a, you at least need to stop, take a breath, and give some thought to that.
Yeah. So I know you don't regret your worldview transformation from the perspective of your own growth and the development of your thinking. And I also know you don't disagree with all of your former views, but you are a public intellectual and you did put ideas into the public consciousness that influenced policy in ways you now disagree with. And you did so for reasons that were not always intellectual, but sometimes very personal. So do you have regrets about the impact that some of your ideas have had?
My instinct here is to say, no, I don't. And then I try to defend that position. But I'm a little unsettled by that instinct. Mm. I contributed to and authored ideas and arguments that once put out there were embraced by others and used to legitimate enterprises, which in retrospect, I could not possibly credit.
Like what?
I want to talk about affirmative action for just a minute, if I can.
Okay, yeah.
I was a 33-year-old scholar who became a full professor at Harvard University and was the first African-American tenured in the economics department. And I labored under the burden of thinking that people thought that I wasn't good enough to have such an elevated position because affirmative action existed and it had been relevant in my case.
Oh,
okay.
Uh-huh.
So part of my animus against affirmative action was rooted in my own chafing at not being seen for, you know, the brilliant, the self-made, perfectly qualified person that I was, and having to dispel people's doubts about my merits because this affirmative action stuff was out there.
Right.
Okay. Now, what I regret is not being aware of the extent to which what I was then pronouncing for the world to be the right or the wrong thing to do was motivated by my own set of issues. And after all, when they took me off the south side of Chicago and enrolled me with a full scholarship at Northwestern University in 1970 and opened up the whole world of intellectual development to me, which completely transformed my life. I was a college dropout. They took a chance on me. In other words, they engaged in affirmative action. So here I am, a beneficiary of at every turn, and I become not just a critic, I become the face in some sense, me and Shelby Steele and Clarence Thomas, of this assault. Not reform, but it's corrupt at its core. It violates the basic tenets of American democracy. It's a whatever, whatever. So, I mean, if you want to find hypocrisy in the record of Glenn Locke, man, I'm not sure I was wrong in every respect.
Right.
I was wrong-headed.
Right, right, right.
You know what I mean?
What else besides affirmative action?
I lent my voice to the bandwagon that was building on the issues of poverty and welfare amongst conservatives. And that ultimately ended up getting expressed in the kind of contract with America that Newt Gingrich and the conservative Republicans in the House of Representatives came up with, and that pushed Bill Clinton way to the right of where I think he might have wanted to be, and certainly where his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, wanted to be, on the welfare reform that became law. That became law and terminated what the Social Security Act of 1935 had established, which was an entitlement of every indigent family to assistance from the state in order to guarantee their income. That entitlement doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
Because of that change in law. And I accept responsibility for having played a role in that. I was a cheerleader to that.
Yeah.
So you got stuff to choose from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So will this, or how will this kind of reckoning feature itself in your memoir?
Okay, so see, this is all about this problem of what I'm calling the problem of self-regard as I try to think through the theory of my memoir. Rationalization is the enemy of sincere self-regard. And that capacity to admit that one was wrong is an essential necessity. A concern for what other people are thinking about one, and a worry that while criticizing myself, honestly, I would give ammunition to those people, is something that one has to overcome. So as I think about the idea, I don't want to give those people the satisfaction of whatever, I realize that I'm confronting a demon, something that stands between me and producing the kind of book that I actually want to write.
Yeah. Yeah. Get that demon out of the way so you can write the best memoir possible. Well, Glenn Lowry, it has been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your courage and your honesty and the good, good work you do today. Glenn Lowry is an economics professor at Brown University focused on racial inequality and social policy. He inspires me to have more equanimity and bemusement at my worldview. Look out for his memoir. Our theme music was composed by Chris Peck. I'm Stephanie Lepp. You can tweet me at Steph Lepp. That's at STEPHLEPP. And you've been listening to Reckonings.